Chapter 1. The Omak Stampede was only another rodeo in those days, and Omak just another lumber town. The year the crash back east, the mill owner's wife, along with her women's group, pressed her husband and cattle barons and the city fathers to adopt ordinances closing the taverns at 9 p.m., and the sheriff was ordered to accost Indians and drovers for vagrancy if they had less than $10 on their person. In the late summer of 1932, two eateries shut their doors, and all three taverns, including the Lucky Seven, which served as the city hall. Ranch hands traded their callings for dam construction in the Coulee and payday whorehouses. The alfalfa second cutting was left standing as no one remained to operate the swathers and balers, let alone buck and stack the bales. The city fathers concluded the winter following that, though the women were fine ladies and five church bells told refined melody Sunday mornings, none were likely to turn their righteous efforts to peddle in flour or fence wire or nails or hammers or supply the manpower to drive them. The mayor, who drew the black lot, traveled to Nez Pelham and promised the tribe a rodeo with longhouses and stick games and walooks and a powwow if they would consider coming in for a community fair. An Indian woman named Pence mentioned moving the Keller downhill race to the Okanagan Sandhill. 6 months later, the inaugural Omak Stampede Rodeo and Suicide Race crowded the town with enough broke drifters and cowhands to tend the ranches through spring. Strahl was a horseman of some repute and a lawman of more renown, though much of it had been fostered in infamy. Nearly 63, he had been invited to join the melee. When he declined, the fairs committee offered to name him parade marshal, and when he again begged off, the city council asked him to fire the starter's pistol for the first night's race. He agreed to attend on the condition that there be no public announcement. His reason was hardly modesty. His reputation was such he would be noted by any he encountered, whether he mounted a pulpit or rode in a convertible automobile. It was also such that half the crowd possessed reason to kill or maim him, some beyond even grudges, so he determined to make it as difficult as possible. Near sunset, half an hour before the race, found him with a group of doddering septuagenarians smoking beneath a tremendous oak at the race's beginning point. Though 10 years their junior, his pigeon toes and inward nature folded his shoulders and shrunk his stature, not unlike the others. In his law days, the posture made him appear earnest and simple, a guise he employed to combat lies of suspects or those close to them. Old Belsby coughed an awful hack. He had been ill for 2 months, though there was nothing other than the sniffles going about. It was likely the men around him had stood at his wedding and certain they would carry him to his rest, but without a son to take on his ground, his widow would be compelled to auction implements and all. Huddled in their snap shirts and bolo ties, they calibrated Belsby's days and their own assets and those of others. Ground was truth past title and deed, past the addition or subtraction or algebra or calculus they learned in school, or the God they learned in church, or the trite history lesson a politician might use to lever a vote. A trousseau inarguable, it required no faith at all. Ground simply was. Strahl's own 500 acres he'd bequeathed early to his children, a mistake slowly bankrupting him, though dirt and its flora knew no difference. The participants in the race had begun to separate themselves from the crowd. They swapped whiskey bottles and laudanum in a tight group, while below the rodeo announcer delivered scores on the last few bull riders and chided the clowns draped on the stock chutes. Laughter and talk and periodic applause wafted up the embankment along with the smell of fry bread in the concession cooker grease. Strahl checked the blank rounds in the starter pistol, then examined the course, which opened with a leap onto a 62-degree grade that hurtled 100 yards into the Okanagan River. Once man and horse were across and up the bank, they labored a 100-yard incline into the rodeo grounds. As the events in the rodeo round wound up, the announcer directed the audience above and behind the north bleachers. Lights mounted to poles that lined the course suddenly blinded the onlookers. Horses turned blanched as the moon reared and wheeled. They grunted as the last of the riders cinched the saddles. One began to nicker and fight its bridle. The other animals responded until the whole field was astir. Riders yipped, armed themselves with quirts and tied leather pouches filled with gravel, meant not to stir their mounts, but beat passing riders. The mare nodded toward Strahl, who lifted his arm and squeezed off a shot. Animal and man leapt at the bluff and piled as one down a hill too steep to hold plant or seed. In a breath, half the riders covered the 200 yards to the water. The rest remained in a fog of men and horse flesh tumbling toward the Okanagan River. Those still aboard their mounts floundered through water, swam a few yards, then lumbered into the rodeo grounds, which were once again filled with sound and light. The other riders littered the grade in the nearest bank, hobbled with broken ankles, dislocated shoulders, cracked ribs, and cracked skulls. Their horses drank at the water's edge as if suddenly and quietly pastured. Three tested broken legs, stunned that something as certain as bone could be so quickly cast into doubt. Later, in the rendering yard, they'd be put down for pig feed. The crowd quieted. The temperature was stifling, and Strahl's duties as honorary marshal were finished. He started a second cigarette and admired the orange ember cooking the paper. In the clear sky, he could discern the constellations. They were all that was left of his mother's teaching, stars in the sky that someone once thought made pictures. Strahl searched for the Rotarians and his check. They were uneasy in his presence and wouldn't keep him long. In his police days, when their tone bent towards Hottie, Strahl would soon follow with a stop at their business, one of their children in tow. He'd confine evidence of their daughters letting lowlifes into their pants or their sons stealing skin books for self-abuse. Not crimes, he'd say, just unbecoming. Not what a community man would want out. The old-timers drifted toward a stand that hawked cold drinks. One wiry man remained, sly to build. His hands smoothed his long mustache, and his blue eyes blinked in the dusty air. He wore a gray county sheriff's cap. "Well, I guess you know why I'm here," the man said. "You're going to offer me some work, Officer Dice, or arrest me. Both possibilities have been considered." "And?" "The former. We want to contract you." "Why waste the time and the money? The reservation is across a river from you," Strahl told him. Dice remained quiet. "And it's not your jurisdiction." "No, it's not." "Let the tribal police hunt him then." Dice looked into his hands. "It's more complicated than that." Strahl laughed. Dice was sheriff of the neighboring county, but rarely absent from his office except to walk across the street to town hall and lunch with the mayor. At his insistence, his picture appeared in the weekly papers next to the crime blotter, though he had investigated nothing rougher than a trespassing since succeeding Strahl as sheriff. Even when Jasper Sampson was arrested by vigilantes for burning outbuildings, then lit his jail cell on fire and cooked himself, Dice let a federal man clean it up. It wasn't that he had no stomach for the work. He saw no profit in it. Hiram Evans meant to give up the state house the following winter. A well-meaning neighbor had approached Strahl himself about an appointment to the position, but Dice wasn't waiting for any encouragement. Strahl hollered at a passing boy, "Bring me a cold drink, and be quick." The boy pointed at himself. Strahl nodded. "Yes, sir." The boy turned for the drink stand. "You didn't give him any money," Dice said. "He'll be glad to treat." Dice watched him go. The rodeo below was breaking up. Strahl listened to the audience's steps clatter the bleachers' planks. "You hunted George Taylor," Dice said. "Taylor was a bank robber from the Great War. He stuck up two old nationals in one day. A week later, Strahl discovered his abandoned sedan at Leahy Junction. He borrowed a mount and followed him north as far as the Columbia, then east through the reservation. Finally, he killed Taylor through a line shack window while the man fried bacon at the wood stove." Dice stuck his hand in his pocket. "Put the state boys on the bastard," Strahl told him. "They been," he said. "They got to have a lead or two then." "Not a sniff." Dice paused and lit a cigarette, then offered one to Strahl, who declined as he was still working on his own. "Heard you got some help," Dice said. "Hired man?" Strahl shook his head. "Dot's husband." "I thought he was educated." "Can't eat a sheepskin." Them shysters back east rung us good, haven't they? My meals are still arriving regularly enough, Strahl said. Dice drew from his cigarette, his pinched face pinked in the glow. That dam coming along? Strahl asked him. Now that Roosevelt has shook Congress by the collar. Roosevelt was a liar, but good at it. He'd requested money for a high dam in Grand Coulee, like Hoover's, but Congress had only funded enough for a low structure. Roosevelt ordered the engineers to go ahead with their original proposition anyway, then told Congress to either finish a chore or explain $5 million for a dam that stopped no water. Workers thick as ants on an anthill is what I've heard. Dice nodded. Registered voters all, I presume. As soon as they cash their checks. Strahl leaned into the oak. The striped bark pressed lines into the skin on his arm. Would you consent to examine a body at least, Dice asked him. Where? Trax's meat locker. Family don't mind you keeping him in a cooler? Storing him isn't nearly as cruel as killing him was. Strahl had planned to cross the river to Nest Pelham in the next week to sharpen the saw blades at Clara's mill anyway. Visiting the butcher wouldn't put him out. I'll look at a body, Strahl said. The boy returned. He handed Strahl the paper cup, and Strahl took it and drank. Dice tossed the child a quarter, and the boy looked at it. You want some, too? The boy inquired. Dice shook his head. The boy vanished. You got a kind streak for children? Strahl asked him. I'm happy to treat, too, Dice said. Strahl blew a cloud of cigarette smoke his direction and watched him blink. We've got three counties that meet within 15 miles of one another, Dice told him. Well, you all put your heads together, then. There's money in it, is what I'm saying. Might be handy. Strahl turned the cup in his hand. How's that wife of yours? Strahl asked him. She's nothing to this affair. Affair, Strahl said. A word that fills both barrels, doesn't it? He turned the paper cup until he found its seam and then slid his thumbnail under the corner and began unraveling the coating. How long you been copping? Strahl asked. Including time as your deputy? 10 or 12 years, I guess. In all that time, have you ever once known anyone to twist my tail? No, Dice said. Or heard me like a woman? Dice shook his head. Strahl spat on the ground and smiled hard. You think when I left that badge in the drawer, I left what was behind it in there, too? Dice extinguished his cigarette into the heel of his boot, looked at Strahl one more time. Dice had shoved too hard, coaxed too little, and Strahl waited to see if he possessed sense enough to retreat. And when he turned and walked back to his car without a word, Strahl gave him credit, at least for that. He watched a patrol car pull away, a boxy Chevy magazine ads claim delivered 80 miles an hour on a straightaway.